My name is Marilyn Peters, and today, October 16, 1985, I'm interviewing Mr. Leslie Manley and his wife, Katie, in connection with the St. Catherine College Oral History Project. Mr. Manley owns and operates a dairy farm in the Lincoln Homestead area of Washington County. He runs his dairy operation with the help of his wife, Katie, and children, Leslie, Karen, Doug, and Mike. Mr. and Mrs. Manley have another son, Scott, who is married to Rose Marie Spalding and lives in Lexington. Mr. Manley is a graduate of University of Kentucky, and Mr. and Mrs. Manley were 1972 winners of the Young Dairy Couple, representing Kiana Division of Dairymen Incorporated. Mr. Manley is the director of Kiana Division of Dairymen Incorporated at present. He is also advisor of the Dairy Committee at U of K under the Dean of Agriculture. He was a previous member of the now-defunct State Milk Commission for 8 years. He has been director of Kentucky Dairy Records, a state organization, for 6 years, and current president. He is also president of Washington County Dairy Herd Improvement Association and newly appointed director of Dairy and Food Nutrition Council of the Southeast. Mr. Manley, when and where were you born?
I was born in Fayette County in 1940.
Who are your parents?
Mr. and Mrs. Farmer Manley.
Do you have brothers and sisters?
Yes, I have three brothers.
Could you give me the
Jerry, Dudley, and Jean.
Did you grow up on a farm?
Yes, I grew up on a farm.
Describe your childhood on the farm.
Well, we were, of course, lived in Lexington. To start with, my father worked as an employee for his father-in-law, managing a farm. And then when his father, or my mother's father, died, they were left a farm. And he acquired another farm and became a farm operator, operating a dairy. And my childhood growing up on the farm was doing the normal chores on a farm, really not connected with the dairy side of it because he had people employed to do the milking. But we did the normal things, feeding chickens after school, putting up hay on the weekends, hauling manure, and all that type of things that you get into.
Is there a long line of farmers in your family or your grandparents, etc.?
Yes, my grandparents really on both sides were farmers. And I suppose it goes on further back. I've got on my dad's side, he had 10 in his family. And I guess there were 5 boys and 5 girls, and all 5 of the boys were farmers. And on my mother's side, out of the, I think she had, three brothers, and 2 of those are farmers. So they're all connected to the farm. My grandfather was, on my mother's side again, was a large landowner there in Lexington and connected with milk manufacturing as well as normal farming, general farming.
Are your parents still farming?
My dad died in, 1981, 2, somewhere in there. My mother's still running the farm. She's got 2 farms, one in Lexington, Fayette County, one in Woodford County. One of my brothers operates the farm in Fayette County, which has a dairy on it, and my other brother operates a farm in Woodford County, and she's the sole owner of those 2 farms, and she still operates those 2.
Could you explain a little bit more what your brothers and sisters are doing at the present time?
Well, my oldest brother is a salesman of farm chemicals, head salesman for one of them, and out of Memphis, Tennessee, and has been in that job, really has been off the farm for probably 25 years, hasn't really been connected with it. And my next oldest brother, who's 3 years older than I, has been on the farm really since high school. When he graduated from high school, he stayed with the farm and has been running the dairy farm except for the time that I was there. Now, I served some time in the military, 6 years, and then I came back to the farm with my dad and my brother. I run the dairy part of it, and my brother run the farm part of it. And then since I left to buy my own farm, he's been operating the farm totally by himself. My next brother, who's younger than I am, about 3 years or 7 years younger than I, he runs the farm. It's kind of a general farm, tobacco farm. And he's been there, I guess, about 10 years.
You said you were in the military. Can you tell me a little bit about when you were in the military?
Well, when I graduated from UK in 1963, I guess 3 weeks later, we were in the U.S. Air Force. I went through the ROTC program at the University of Kentucky and went in as a second lieutenant. Our first base was Glasgow Air Force Base, Montana. I almost had to look up on the map to see if Montana was a member of the Union. You know, I hadn't heard much of Montana, and it was kind of an isolated spot for us. We had our first child, I guess, 2 months later.
Almost.
We always call that good planning because the Air Force paid for that one about $7.50, I think is what he cost. But we served there for a year and a half. I was a food service officer there for a while, and then I became a commissary officer, which is similar to operating a supermarket on the outside. And then we were shipped to Guam, and we spent 2 years there. I had another child in between. Scott was born in Lexington before we got there, and then Doug was born in Guam. So we've got our children's birth dates are all, or our birthplaces are all scattered around. I served as a food service officer when I was in Guam during the Vietnam buildup when they started flying a lot of the B-52s out of there. We served something like 6,000 meals a day, so I was in charge of about 220 employees, and at one time we were voted the top dining hall in the Air Force. So as a result of that, I think that helped me get a command, what they call a command food service officer's job, which is at command headquarters in Omaha, Nebraska. And that's where we served another year and a half in command headquarters. And there my job was to carry out the food service organization for all of the Strategic Air Command. And from there we got out of the service. We'd spent about 6 years in the service. That was kind of the, I ended up as a captain and got out with over 6 years of service.
Mrs. Manley, where are you from?
I'm from Lexington.
What was your maiden name?
Johnson.
Did you grow up on a farm?
No, I didn't. I'm an ex-city girl.
How do you feel about being on a farm now? Is it was it a very drastic change for you?
Well, definitely it was a drastic change because I didn't, you know, not growing up on a farm, I didn't really know what to expect. But I kind of wished I had grown up on a farm. I might have been more prepared to rather than just jumping in, I guess. But I enjoy it, and I would much rather be I'm kind of stumped.
Well, the thing that kind of came in there, you know, we were married sophomores in college. I was a sophomore in college, and we had dated 5 years previous to that, and so she knew something about the farm. You know, she says she didn't, but she I can tell some good tales on her getting exposed to the dairy farm. I know one time we had a pet sheep come running around the patio and on the farm, and it like scared her to death. She wondered what that thing was. And another time she asked my dad how his tobacco sold, and said did it sell for $100 a pound. And, of course, that tickled my dad to pieces. But she was well indoctrinated. Of course, we dated from the time we were 15, I guess. And then we had the service break. Of course, I went to college before then, so we had this 2 or 3 years there, and she was exposed to the farm somewhat because I majored in farming, in dairy production. And then we were gone 6 years. So the one reason she and I both discussed is probably one of the hardest decisions we ever made was getting out of the service, because we had been in the service so long, 6 years, getting a paycheck every 2 weeks. And trying to talk to my dad, we knew we'd like to get out to a certain extent. It's not something I guess I felt like I wanted to make a career, even though as far as Eric, of course, was concerned, I was going to be a career person. I didn't have what they call a DOS or data separation. And but we decided that some of the things we were missing was, and we wanted to do, was one, we wanted to be near our parents more. And we had 3 children then, and we wanted them to know our parents, you know, get to know them, which up till then we'd go home twice a year maybe and see them for 2 or 3 weeks, and then they were gone. So they really didn't know their parents. And some of the things we discussed, that was probably the major thing, is that we wanted to raise our children on the farm, to be able to teach them some responsibility, and to be near our parents so they get to know them. And from then on, you know, we talked ideally about some of the things we'd like to get, and I think back on it, you know, that, you know, wouldn't it be nice to get out of the service, and we'd go horseback riding and walk in the sunset and all that stuff, you know. And sometimes you look back on it, and you're so busy that you don't get to enjoy some of those things that are there every day, you know, the sunrise and things. And, we still have those things in mind.
When did you marry? What year?
We married in January of 1960.
Well, can you tell me more about your college life, your major?
Well, I majored in dairy production. Again, that was kind of confusing type of thing. I can remember going to as a freshman, and I probably wouldn't have gone. I'm the first of my family to get a college degree out of 4 boys. And neither one of my parents had college degrees, or anyone behind them had college degrees. So probably if it hadn't been for my mother pushing me a little bit, I probably wouldn't have gone. I was kind of average in school. I wouldn't say I was real smart, or I wasn't dumb either. I was kind of in the maybe high B's in there somewhere. And after I can still remember going to the old Coliseum. That was when everybody had to stand outside in line and go through the doors and go to the, get your classes one by one, you know, and go to all the various tables. And I can remember standing in that line as a freshman and not registering yet and looking up and wondering. I had no idea what I'd wanted to be. And I looked up and I saw ag engineering. And I said, well, I know ag, you know. And I said, that's what I'm going into. So I started out in ag engineering and took, I think, advanced, what was it, geometry and calculus and a couple other math courses. And I said, I got through that first one, and I said, I got a 2 point, which at that time, I think 50% of the class failed. So I thought I was probably, if I survived that, I could make it. But I got out of ag engineering real quick and got into dairy production, which is more suited to me. And basically, of course, we got married in our sophomore year, so our social life as far as being intertwined around any fraternities or on-campus social functions was not that. It was more we had married friends that we socialized with and did the, you know, the classwork. And she worked full-time going through college, and I worked once at Kroger's for a while, stocking shelves about 25, 30 hours a week, and then I sold clothes for the rest of the time, I guess, 2 or 3 years. We scraped by. I think we counted here the other day that we lived in 7 different places during our college stay. Sometimes we had an opportunity to stay in a person's house when they were called up during a Cuban crisis. And all we had to do was pay the interest on their loan. So we got a fully furnished complete house for about a year and a half. Another time we stayed in an apartment and I cleaned hallways and what have you to lower the rent. So it was work and going to school and some social life.
Mm-hmm. Where did you work?
My first job was between my junior and senior year in high school as a legal secretary. Then I worked as a secretary for the telephone company and then a secretary for Kentucky Utilities up until he went into the service.
Les, how do you think that your college education has really helped you on the farm?
Well, as I've probably told the boys a number of times, that the college degree doesn't really guarantee you anything. I think the thing that I look back on, it gives you some confidence in yourself. It gives you the ability to move up the, I guess you would call it the intellectual ladder or whatever, that you feel comfortable talking to extension personnel, people with doctorate degrees, or you can feel comfortable moving the other direction. And at any time that I've ever run into any problem trying to solve a particular problem on the farm or need more information, I've never failed to know who to contact because a lot of those people I went to school with, and they were either my professors or I knew them personally and could call them on the phone and feel free to do so. I knew what the environment was and feel very comfortable in it when I call them or call on them to help.
Describe when and how you think you first really developed your interest in farming.
Well, that's kind of hard to say. I look back on it when we were going to school I guess I was majoring in dairy production. I probably went that direction because I came off of a dairy farm, not necessarily because I was so connected with the dairy farm, because as I said before, we didn't really have to do a lot of the milking. My dad had some people hired to do the milking. We did more of the outside farm work. But when you go to the university, you have to have some type of curriculum to kind of point yourself, so I ended up in dairy production. Then went into the service for 6 years and probably was, they don't really know what to do with a guy with a dairy production degree, so they ended up sticking me in food service as a food service officer. And even though we did know we were, at that time, not planning on staying in the service, because I used to hate the service. When I was going to ROTC at the university, that's the first thing I'd do. I'd take off my uniform and, you know, you're supposed to wear it all day, and I would change it just as soon as I'd get out of class. And we had a 3-year obligation at one time when we were supposed to go in. And one of the first things we found out after I got in that we had a 4-year obligation. They didn't tell us that, but we ended up staying 6 anyways. That didn't make much difference. We enjoyed it. But when we decided that we wanted to come back, and we wanted to come back to the farm, and my dad just said, come home, basically. You know, we never could work out anything. We were trying to talk to my dad and say, well, you know, it's kind of tough to give up a known paycheck and with 3 kids and a wife to support and just come home and to an unknown quantity. I didn't even know how farmers made a living. You know, where does that money come from? I'm used to getting a paycheck every 2 weeks from the military. But finally we decided that's what we wanted to do. As I said, it was probably one of the most agonizing decisions we made because we felt that was a new direction for us. And we came home and of course I told my brother that I wanted to run the dairy. And after that it just became a kind of a knack. It seemed like I had a knack for knowing what was the right thing to do in the dairy. And I don't know where it came from, or I can't say it all came from my past knowledge that I got from UK, or part of it I think came from the service, knowing what is right and what's wrong. And just then I'm what we'd call it, a voracious reader. I love to read and I love to listen. I've never been embarrassed to ask somebody to help me. And probably most of it's been just reading and almost self-taught to a certain extent.
What year did you begin farming and where?
Well, we came back out of the service April of 1969. Came back to the farm in Lexington. It was about 8 miles from the University of Kentucky campus. And I guess the next day, I got out on like a Friday or Saturday, and I went to work the next day. And I guess it seemed like I didn't let up or have a break for about a year. Sometimes I was working many hours a day, 20 hours a day, to get things where I wanted. And we were there for almost 10 years, I guess, 1969. We bought this farm in April of 78.
This is your first farm?
Right. This is a farm that we bought on our own.
Did you begin with dairy cattle alone? Did you have any other livestock or another crop that you intended to sell when you first began?
No, when we come out, we basically, my dad sold us a third interest in the cattle, and the agreement was that my brother and I would manage the farm, furnish the labor. I would manage the dairy, my brother would manage the crops, and we would each get a third of the milk check. We were milking about 100 cows then, and stayed pretty close to 100. We had been up to 140 and pretty much never got below 100. We did get into some beef cattle at one time, and I managed that. And then we sold our interest in that to a younger brother that wanted to come in too. So that's basically where we started. My dad was kind enough and good enough to allow us to do that and sign a note for us. So mm-hmm. That's where the money came from to get us started. Mm-hmm.
Your first individual operation here, this is your first farm?
First farm on our own.
Mm-hmm. What problems did you encounter when you first began your own farm?
Oh gosh, money probably, more than anything else. Cash flow, and that's been a continuing problem, is to keep up with your bills. And then you get out on your own, and you see a lot of things that you'd like to do and like to change. The topography of the ground, the conservation tillage type of things. Of course, the first things is starting brand new. We had to put together an equipment package and make decisions on size of tractors and how many tractors and what type of plows to go with that, manure handling equipment, how to feed your cows, who you're going to buy it from, and that type of thing.
How has your farm operation here changed through the years that you've been here?
Well, we like to think it's improved. We think we've been able to make some improvements in the soil fertility. We like to feel like we're good stewards of the soil and have done some things to keep the soil from eroding. And we've done that. We've upgraded tremendously the quality of water. When we first came here, you almost dreaded taking a shower or a bath because the water was so bad that you smelled better before you took a bath than after you took a bath. And I think that was a major change, is when we were able to upgrade the water supply here and feel comfortable and safe with it. We've upgraded our cattle over the years, and we feel like we've got much better genetics in our cattle, better production. And of course, our size of our herd has gone from about 20 head to milking right at 100 cows, and we've got another 150 head ready to go. So we probably have increased the size of our herd by about fivefold in 8 years. We've, I think, made a tremendous upgrading in facilities. We've added a pretty good size machine shed that we bought with the farm that was not put together. We put it up, and as I've said, we've reworked the water system and almost completely reworked the plumbing on the farm. to where it's now we've got automatic watering tanks in various fields for our cattle so that they'll have water supply. And we've added a mixed meal type of system to where we can grind and mix our own feed, again trying to hold the cost on feed and improve the quality of feed to the cattle. Basically, I think in every area we've tried to upgrade our crops.
Has your farm grown acreage-wise since you moved here?
No, it was 274 acres when we bought it. It's still, we haven't added anything.
What roles do your children play in relation to the dairy?
Well, we've never, well, I won't say never, there's been twice, we've had two or three times, I guess, we've had some hired help in here, off and on. Originally, when we came up here, I brought a person with me to help me farm, and he stayed with us about a year. Well, not quite a year. He came in April of 78, he left, and he got through the tobacco crop, and then he went back to Lexington. And that was the last year that we raised any tobacco here. We haven't raised any since. The boys have always had since we come out of the service, even at home, they've had an integral part in the dairy operation. I like to brag on them, and we think that we teach responsibility, and I know several times we've, even when we were in Lexington, and Mike, being our oldest, was about 13, we left them in charge of over 100 cow dairy. Scott was 12 and Doug was about 10, I guess, somewhere in there. And we left them completely in charge for about 10 days when we were gone to a meeting. And the only thing that they said when we came back, and the house was clean too. They had to do their own cooking, they did their own laundry and the whole works. The house was clean, the dishes were put up. And the only thing they said was, "Dad, don't let the production drop when we got back." So that goes way back, even when Mike was 6 or 7, they've milked cows, they've known how to milk cows, and they're basically the only ones that have ever milked the cows other than myself, all the years that we've been milking.
How do you think their roles have changed as they've grown older?
Well, I think they've accepted more responsibility, and I've given them more in the decision-making. I've always been reluctant to, especially when they were young, to turn them loose on farm equipment until they were properly taught and knew the safeguards and the dangers of any equipment on the farm, because it's probably one of the most hazardous occupations you can be in. And so now I feel very comfortable with them when they go out on any piece of equipment and do the work. And they're one of the things that we've always done is we've shared finances with them. We talk about what our situation is from a financial standpoint. We talk about decisions we're going to make or change in feeding equipment we're going to buy. And so I guess they've absorbed those over the years, and they just go right on with them. You think sometimes that they don't know what's going on or what, but when you get out of the picture and they have to make those decisions, they just roll right on, just like you're not there. So.
Katie, what do you see as your major role on the farm?
Probably my major role would be taking care of the calves and running here and there for parts when things break down. I haven't really milked the cows very much. I can, but I mainly just take care of the calves and from the time that they're born up until they're several months old, I guess.
How do you think your role has changed since you started working on the farm?
Well, I guess it's maybe picked up a little bit. I probably do more than I did when we first, I'm sure I do more than I did when we first married, or when we were when we got out of the service and were in Lexington, because we had hired people to help us. And since we came here, we don't have any hired help now, and we all have to pitch in and do our part in order for things to get done.
Would you describe your children as individuals, their ages, their education, their goals, anything you'd like to say about your children?
I can add a few little things, but he probably could do better. Mike, of course, is the oldest, and he's 22.
Growing up, he is probably in the medium range of work habits. He's not the real go-getter that maybe Scott is, yet he's diligent in his work. He's always been very good at it. And as far as his goals are concerned, right now I think he would like to stay on the dairy farm. He's got quite a few cattle that belong to him here in the farm, and I would suspect one day he would like to have his own cattle. He's very interested in genetics, and we always thought growing up that he was the green thumb of the family, because he could seem like he could plant about anything and it would grow. Scott, our middle son, is 21, and he's probably the self-motivated one. He's majoring in finance and economics, hopes to get a double major when he graduates this coming year, and has a good job, and has been offered a full-time job with Jericho Incorporated in Lexington, where he's been an intern for the past year. He's always been the type that he's never satisfied with just being 100%. He always reaches for the best that he can do. And I've always admired that in him, because he reaches to be the best in anything he tries to do. He's a fast worker. He is, his individual emotions. I always like to think I'm a good study in motion, and doing things the fastest you can do. And he probably does that as well as anybody, too, in trying to not waste any motion and get a particular job done. Doug, our youngest son at 19, he's probably the most laid back of the three, and as he's grown up, we've had trouble getting him through some of the grade schools, and yet when he took his entrance exam to go to UK, and which kind of shocked us that he'd even bothered to take it, he tested higher than the other two. Scott has been on the dean's list several times, and Mike has been on the dean's list too. So we feel like he's got the basic intelligence to do it. He lacks the motivation and the desire at present to follow on with his education. He has joined the Air Force the Navy, and is planning on going into the Navy in March. So I think that'll be good for him. It'll give him 4 years to mature and find out really what he wants to do, and we'll do better with it. Leslie Karen, being our youngest daughter, she's kind of in between the three boys. Sometimes she can get motivated and do real good work. Sometimes she can't. She's right now, her primary interest is boys, and that seems to fit for the 13-year-olds, and has been doing better. She really enthused me this summer because she works so much harder this summer on the farm, and we're both the type that don't like to force work on children. We like for them to do it without being asked, knowing that the job is there and it needs to be done, and they just do it out of wanting to help out. And she did that probably as well this summer, and we saw a lot of change in her. We see her maturing and becoming a real pretty young lady right now.
Katie, would you like to add anything about your children?
I think he pretty much said it there. I think I would have to add, if I was looking for a nickname for Leslie Karen, I'd have to call her the Cat Lady, because she's so wrapped up in the cats and the animals and She helps me feed the calves too, so she's a pretty, really pretty interested in animals, I would say, right now. Of course, that may change. Who knows?
You said Mike, who had recently graduated from UK, has joined you on the farm. What types of contributions do you feel Mike has made since he's joined your operation?
Well, Mike has taken a major portion of the labor side of it. He gives me some relief in terms of the management, the everyday management, knowing when to feed, when to breed cows, a lot of the little details that I had to keep an eye on, Mike now does and can keep up with it. His major interest seems to be in the dairy cattle, so I would like for him to take more of an interest in the management side of the dairy, and basically it's just relieved about half the load off my shoulders. It's just been a big help to me.
Do you think any of your other children plan to continue in the dairy business?
I would say right now, not, but I've come from a family with three brothers, and the one brother that we all thought would never come back to the farm after serving a 2-year hitch in the Navy and working somewhere else punching a time clock, it wasn't long before he came back to the farm and became a very good farmer. So I always keep my options open, and I'll say one thing, they don't seem to dislike the farm. When Scott, who probably has done the least work on the farm in the last 3 years since he's been in college because he worked up there, when he gets the chance and has the opportunity, he comes home and helps just because he wants to keep his hands in. So to me, that makes me feel like we haven't destroyed their love of farming by working them too hard. You know, we've always tried to, we get our work done and yet we want to play. We love to play basketball. We still go to all the UK ball games if we can, and we are avid sports fans, except for Leslie Caron. And so we've tried to enjoy our farming as we've gone along.
Would you advise your children to continue in farming, looking at the economic situation that has come upon the U.S. in the last few years?
Well, the economic side of it is to say the least, not encouraging. And to hope that one of your children would come into that, knowing the financial side of it, is the thing that I guess I dislike most about the farming side of it, is that you never have any time, just absolutely free time, that you can do some things for yourself or for your family. When you do take the time, it's just, you feel guilty almost, because there's another 3 or 4 weeks worth of work sitting there waiting for you to do. I know a lot of people ask me if I'm caught up with my farm work, and I said, no, I'm not caught up. I'm just caught up with my finances now, and I'm just waiting. But on the plus side of it, and there are a lot of pluses on farming, the closeness of the family. There's not many people that Katie and I work together every day. We're not separated. We love that. And we've been married 25, going on 26 years. And that was one of the things we wanted when we come out. You know, I don't. She doesn't wave goodbye to me in the morning at 7 o'clock and doesn't see me. My kids are the same way. You know, we see each other every day and have an input with each other every day. We eat lunch here together. The sunrise, the sunsets you see on the farm, the change of the seasons, the birth of a new calf, those type of things are intangibles that you don't get paid for, but they're there, and you don't have to punch a time clock. You know, you're kind of your own boss to a certain extent. And all those things, to me, are still important. The financial side of it, as long as you've got, you eat well and you have a decent house over your, or a roof over your head, and those type of things, you know, we're not really looking for financial riches as such. So I would still say farming is where I would like to be. And that's, you know, if that's the things that the kids want, we've kind of left those, you know, we haven't pointed their directions and said you have to do this or you have to do that. We have always wanted them to pursue a good education, and we've always felt a good college degree is a must. And I guess we feel like we've done our job if we've exposed them to all those things. I've never felt like a person, especially coming off of a farm, should stay on a farm at 16 or 17 right out of high school, because he hasn't been exposed to some other things, other avenues of education. And, even my youngest son going in the Navy, I think will get an education apart from what he would get here and help him mature and know what he wants to do.
What are your major problems in the dairy business today?
The major problem is still not making enough money, just put it very simply, not making profit. I think a lot of the things that you hear about throughout the farm sector is still profit related. Even though the Ag Department, State Ag Department, and the federal government says that dairy people are making more than any other commodity, that just makes the dairy people wonder, you know, how is anybody else making any money, because it's just not there. We make a lot of money, you know, gross money we make a lot, but it takes a substantial amount of money to pay the interest on your loans, feed your cattle, breed your cattle, utility bills, that type of thing. So I'd still, the biggest problem is still cash related.
Have you had any problems with drought or losing crops or livestock?
No, we haven't had any major catastrophes. We've been real fortunate not having any hail or any wind damage, no fires of any substance that would be either life-threatening or shortage. We had the drought, of course, in 1983, which was a substantial setback financially for us, as well as cutting our production and that type of thing. But other than that, we haven't.
What other crops do you produce besides your livestock market?
Well, the only other crops we produce are for consumption by our dairy cows. We raise about 90 acres of corn, both for shell corn and for silage, and we'll raise probably 40 to 50 acres of hay and alfalfa hay for the consumption by the cows.
What do you look for in the breeding phase of your dairy operation?
Well, we're always attempting to upgrade our herds. We don't use any natural bulls. We artificially breed all of our cows, both heifers and the milking cows. And we're always searching to improve the genetics. We have our herd, what they call mated, in terms of, what happens is you take a look at the cow from a physical standpoint and try to mate her with a cow or with a bull that would correct any faults she may have. That's from a type standpoint, and then of course you're always trying to breed to improve her production, or not her production, but her offspring's production and butterfat production. So we think we've been getting that done. It's a slow process. Because you breed a cow today, you won't see any results for 3 years.
What impact has mechanization made on your dairy?
Well, mechanization is probably, we think we have it hard today, and you think back even my childhood growing up, we had silos where all of us boys had to go up into those silos after school every day and pitch silage out onto a wagon. Then we had to go out into the fields and pitch it out on the ground and to feed 100 cows a day. And of course, I guess you could go back a little further and know that cows were milked by hand. And I have had to shovel manure from a lot of 100 cows. And back before you had front end loaders and manure spreaders and that type of thing. So. We can feed, now we can feed with automatic unloaders in our silos, with automatic feeders. We can go push a button and stand there for 10 minutes and feed 100 cows, and the highest or worst physical labor you've got is pushing a button. Of course, it takes something to get it in there, but that's still all mechanized. You've got tractors that chop the silage and wagons now that are automatic unloading. You don't have to do any of the physical work. Probably tobacco and hay are two of the things that have not lended themselves too well to mechanization, but even then, we've made a great strides over the years. We did put our own mix meal in to mix and grind our own feed, and that's a degree of mechanization that a lot of farms don't have. Again, we're trying to cut out the middleman and buy our feed more direct and pass the savings on to us rather than on to somebody else. Milking-wise, here when we bought the farm, we had what they call a single six herringbone, which means you can only milk six cows at a time. Which when we started with 25 or 30 head, it wasn't any big problem. But then as we grew and got up to 60 and 70, it was taking us 8, 9, 10 hours to milk. And then you had all your other work to go with that outside. So about 3 years ago, I guess, we added on, 2 years ago probably, we added on another side, and now it's a double six, and we went from milking about 18 cows an hour to about 36 to 40 cows an hour. And of course we're right at 100 cows, and now we can milk in about 3 hours, twice a day, which would be six, and that gives us, even though we're milking more cows, it gives us more time outside the parlor to do our other chores.
I read recently where they have a bill that is being introduced in Congress that's going to make us price support, if passed, on corn and various feed markets, where it would make it, the price would be on a card, such as tobacco, and it would be making it illegal to sell like corn to your neighbors or anything for a price any cheaper than what the price supports is set at. How do you think this is going to affect your operation or the operation of farmers in general if it's passed?
Well, if they have passed a price support level on, well, I guess they have always had to a certain degree, a loan program on most of the commodity grains. And even though we're a major purchaser of shell corn, for instance, or soybean meal or distillers grains, we've always found that when these people are doing well, we do well. Even though our price goes up, it seems like it just brings the rest of the whole farm sector up. It seems like we kind of ride with the grains, and I would say it would be good for them.
What equipment do you own and operate on your dairy?
Well, we have two tractors, which is probably less than most farms. Most farms would have four. We started with two, and we have, outside of our initial purchase of any equipment, we haven't made any major additions to our equipment. I guess I'm partially proud of that because I felt like we made the right decisions to begin with and have stayed with them. We've got a large tractor, 150 horsepower tractor, and an 80 horsepower tractor. We have a five-bottom plow. We have a manure spreader, a 3,000-gallon liquid manure spreader. And we have what they call a side flail manure spreader to handle both liquid or dry manure. We've got a two-row no-till corn planter. We have a 13-foot cutting harrow. We did recently go with our neighbors and bought a chisel plow. It's cost us about $400 a piece, I think, to be able to work our ground a little quicker and, again, from a soil conservation standpoint, to conserve our soil. We've got a 9-foot New Holland hay bine, a baler. Of course, we put up the mixed meal. What else, Katie, do you think? Got a manure pump to pump the liquid manure. basically the very raw ingredients to get the job done. We've got a hay rake, an old hay rake, and all of those things were purchased 8 and 9 years ago, and we've spent a major portion, it seems like every year, and it gets worse, to keep these things going. Our repair costs keep going up. We've spent a lot of money this year on, well, we've got our silage equipment too. We've got a chopper and two wagons and a blower, so those three things there are pretty major. But that's what we have, just the very basic ingredients.
What do you feel is the most important piece of equipment you have on your dairy?
Oh, no doubt it's my milking equipment. I've spent a lot of money, and that's where all our money comes from, and we've spent probably more than a lot of people would do to keep our milking parlor and our equipment in the milking parlor operating properly at all times if we can. The milking equipment, we're in contact with it 7 and 8 hours every day. They're in contact with the cows, and if not operating properly, can cause you more damage and more heartache and financial woes than about any other piece of equipment you've got. So I say our equipment that's in the dairy parlor has to be the most important.
Is there any equipment that you would particularly like to add to your dairy operation?
Oh, gosh, we dream all the time. Things we know that we're right now cooperate with our neighbor. He's in the same predicament we are. He's got no labor and two tractors, no silage equipment. We have not enough labor and we have the silage equipment, but not enough tractors to get our silage equipment, our silage job done, because you normally need at least two more tractors. So he and I cooperate and he brings his two tractors over, and then I help him by chopping his silage. And so I would say that there's a lot of jobs that I could see that sometimes we have the labor to get it done, but we have two tractors that are busy. And so I would like to add probably a 100 horsepower tractor and a 50 or 60 horsepower tractor would be two major things I would add if I had the money to do it.
What improvements have you made in the health and feeding practices of area of your operation?
Well, in the health and feeding of dairy cows, I'm probably the world's worst in trying to always improve and get more production from my cows. Again, I've said earlier that I'm always read quite a bit and read of new practices or something, and research that's been done that I think would have an impact on our herd in terms of higher production, more efficient production. So we've basically have I think always tried to manage our herd from a standpoint of their health and their feeding practices to a high degree. We've practiced herd health, what we call a herd health program, where you have a veterinarian come in and pregnancy check cows or check the sterility of cows and see if you can get them bred a little quicker. Our mastitis control, again, that gets back to your equipment and proper milking techniques, and we think we're hopefully up on top of that. Feeding, we do ration analysis, forage balancing, those type of things that are important in trying to give your cows the right ingredients, feed ingredients to maximize production. And really about genetics, breeding, we'd like to stay away from the bull. Again, that helps you from a health standpoint or a safety standpoint, because you don't have a large bull running around that could do injury to not only yourself but your family and cattle and what have you. But they also spread disease if they happen to have one, and you could spread that among your cows right quick if you didn't know about it. All those things we try to stay up on top of everything.
What types of immunizations and vaccines do you give to your cattle?
Well, we recently had to go through and vaccinate all the herd for what they call Haemophilus. A veterinarian titered Haemophilus out of some cattle that we feel like probably came in here from some we bought in Pennsylvania, and can cause abortions, early abortions in cattle. So we went through and vaccinated all those. We've always vaccinated for brucellosis. That has to be done between 3 to 6 months of age. We've done that all the time. We vaccinate for blackleg. We vaccinate for lepto, 5 strains of lepto. We're getting ready to go through and vaccinate our calves for IBR and BVD. And I guess we went through all our cows and did that at the same time we did on the Haemophilus. We've done all those things.
Is there any phase of farming that you will wish to know more about personally?
Well, when I came to the farm, our farm here, I came from a background of not having done much work in the farming side of it, because my brother on the home farm did the farming, and I did the dairy side of it. So when I left, he had to know the farming side, or the dairy side, and I had to learn the farming side almost from the ground up. When I came here, I hadn't even plowed, I don't guess, turned over a bit of ground. And I'd never planted any corn, all those things. So I'm always interested in them and improving my knowledge of how to do that and do a better job of it. Fertility techniques, how to plow, or when to plow, corn varieties, hay, how to take care of hay and that type of thing. Oh, dairy, I'm never satisfied with what I'm doing in terms of dairy or anything related to my work, because anything I read I think might be an improvement or might be a way to do something better. I'll try it. Probably to a certain degree bad, but to a certain degree too, you're always seeking perfection and you never get it, but if you don't try it, you never get anywhere.
Will you two describe your work with DI and then also your work with the Kiana division?
Well, the Dairymen Incorporated, or the Kiana division of Dairymen Incorporated, is a milk co-op that was formed in, I guess, about 1968 or 69, and we've been involved with it since we come out of the service. I've been a director when we were in Lexington for about 7 years, and then when I moved to Springfield, I lost my directorship because of moving to a new district, and was recently elected as a director from this area after being off the board for about 4 or 5 years. We are former winners of their Young Dairyman Couple competition. I've been vitally involved in what the co-op's been doing and promoting the co-op causes for the last 15, 16 years. We've been involved in when we were qualified from an age group standpoint, we were involved in the Young Dairy Couple thing, and I've served as a judge once several years ago for the Young Dairyman competition, along with our county agent from the county. But that's basically what we've been involved in. The Kentucky Dairy Records thing and the Washington County DHIA are testing organizations where you test your cows, test the production, and you pick up management information and you put it on a computer sheet, and it gives the farmer management tools to work with. It puts on a computer sheet what his breed dates are for his cows, what the cow produced in terms of milk each month, how much milk she's projected to give and she's actually given, so you can take that information, decide who's a paying cow and who's not. You can take the breed information and determine whether you're having trouble from a management standpoint getting your cows bred, or if you're not getting them bred soon enough. There's mastitis information on there that gives you management information to decide if you're having trouble with mastitis. All those things are parameters that come under DHIA. I've been involved in dairy herd improvement associations, both in Fayette County, where I served as a president and treasurer for I guess, 8 or 9 years there. And then when I came here, we had about 6 herds on test, I think. And now we're probably one of the best associations in the state, having about 32 to 33 members. Very active group. I've served as president off and on for out of 8 years, probably about 4 or 5 years, I guess, I've served as president or director. I guess I've been off the board once, I don't know, 1 year out of the 8. And just a real vital organization, and trying to really get a management tool to the dairymen. Kentucky is probably one of the lowest in, it is the lowest in terms of number of cows on test. In the union, we're ranked 50th, and I guess to say I'm ashamed of that is putting it mildly. But now I've served as director on a state board, and now serving as president, and feel like I'm in a position where I can help change some of that. And I think some of our
you were talking about your work with Kentucky Dairy Records and Dairy Herd Improvement. Would you like to continue, please?
Well, I was saying that now that I'm serving as president of the state organization, we've been able to, we're hoping to take some of the things that we've accomplished here in the county in promoting and revitalizing the testing and getting more people on test, and carry that on to the state level, and at least move the state up in terms of number of cows on test. And at the same time, I think we're doing a service for the dairy farmer by giving him a management tool that he can use to stay competitive in today's market.
Have government regulations had an impact on your dairy operation?
Of course, the government regulations, we're probably one of the most regulated commodity groups that we have. You've got the, from a health standpoint, you've got the sanitarians that tell you under what conditions you can produce milk. It's tested from a standpoint of bacteria count, leukocyte count. The sample of your milk is pulled every time it's shipped from your farm, and checked to see that there's no antibiotics, no water, no bacteria count is low and meets government standards. So from that standpoint, we're regulated. We have the Caper-Volstead Act, which permits dairy farmers to band together to market their milk, and that's where you get Dairymen Incorporated. I think that has played a vital role in preserving the dairy farmers and helping them to stay economically sound over the years. And if not for their existence today, I think you'd see the price of milk much lower than it is. Then from a standpoint of the price support program, that has an influence on us as well. It helps put a floor on the, base price, if you will, on the price of milk. And when the market or the law of supply and demand brings the price down, then the government agrees to take off off the market a certain amount of non-fat dry milk, butter, and cheese, this type of thing. I think that serves a twofold purpose. One, it helps the consumer because it removes the peaks and valleys out of the dairy business. As you know, I've mentioned before that when I breed a cow, and it's 3 years down the road before you have any results. So it's not the type of thing that you can shut the faucet off or shut it on depending on what the demand is. And if the consumer had to, or if the farmer did not have the support program and had to ride those waves or the valleys, peaks and valleys out, then I think the consumers would be the ones that would pay some of the price. You'd see a wide swings in the price of milk. And so that I think that helps in all the support programs that the government helps. I think it helps the consumer as much as it does the farmer. You read in the press about all the farmers that are going broke and what have you. So to say the farmers are getting rich off the support programs, I think is non-existent. But on the other side, I think the figure they use now is that the food in the United States takes about 14% of the net take-home pay of the American consumer, which is one of the best in the world. And you can imagine the impact it would have on all the economy in the United States if the people were having to pay, say, 45 to 50% of their take-home pay was going to just purchase food and subsist. That would change drastically housing markets, real estate values, cars, manufactured items, all those things. So I think it serves both the farmer and the consumer.
How do you feel about the import-export situation?
Well, it seems like to me the government is hinging everything on the exporting of our food. Now I realize that especially from the grain standpoint, that is where it would help our farmers to be able to export these grains. And of course you read about the starving nations, Africa, South Africa, and places like this, that where people are going hungry, or we've got people going hungry here in the United States. But from a dairy standpoint, it doesn't seem to me that the export market has any influence on us. We've got the European common market is sitting over there, just would love to export milk to us. So you've got Canada to the north of us, would just love to export milk to us. And milk as such, fluid milk, cannot be exported. It's not a perishable item, so it couldn't be. And there will always be a need for milk, the fluid milk. Now, of course, you can export or cheese, non-fat dry milk, and butter. But again, who are you going to export it to? The ones that need it haven't got the cash, and the ones that have the cash don't need it. They've got plenty of their own supply. So I don't know that has an impact that much on the dairy section. I'm sure it does on the grain.
You also work with the Dairy Committee under the Dean of Agriculture at U of K. Could you explain a little bit about what this committee does?
Well, this committee was formed about 2 years ago, and the purpose of the committee was to put together an advisory group or committee to advise the Dean of Agriculture, specifically probably the head of the dairy section, in terms of the curriculum that they have for the students. Is the curriculum what we want to get the job done? It's to kind of give guidelines to them in terms of research that's being carried on and extension work. It's kind of a three-pronged thing that we advise on, and there's probably about 7 or 8 dairy farmers from throughout the state on that committee, and there's a few from the manufacturing sector, and we meet about twice a year just in an advisory capacity.
You also have been newly appointed to the Dairy Food and Nutrition Council of the Southeast. Could you tell me what your work will be on this council?
Well, this is really kind of the advertising arm of probably through the dairy farmers. They recently approved this 15-cent takeout per hundredweight of milk, which formed the National Dairy Board. And this Food and Nutrition Council is part of American Dairy Association or whatever. I'm not sure exactly how they fit in the organizational structure, but that's basically what it is. And what we'll get into is looking at advertising dollars and how they're spent and how to change that program or what have
you. You also mentioned previously that you worked with the State Milk Commission before it was considered unconstitutional. Can you describe what its purpose was and mainly why it was considered unconstitutional?
Well, the Milk Commission, I was appointed by the governor 7 or 8 years ago, I guess, and was one of two dairy farmers that served on that, about a 7 or 8 member panel. It was made up of about three from the manufacturing side of it and two dairy farmers, and well, there's probably another manufacturing in there. But the Milk Commission, their sole purpose was to ensure that milk was not sold below cost in the state of Kentucky. And the Milk Commission, they were charged with that responsibility to make sure that milk was not sold below cost by any of the supermarkets or chains or whatever might be to outlets for milk. And the reason for that was, I guess, primarily to help protect our own industry, not to use milk as a lost leader as such. And that's basically what we did over the years. Now, it was considered unconstitutional by a recent judge's decision, and this is kind of the way a lot of the milk commissions have been going. There's one that was considered unconstitutional in Tennessee, and the one in North Carolina is being attacked pretty rigidly now. And it's basically saying let the law supply and demand fall where it may, and let people sell where they, you know, whatever price they want to sell it at. If they want to use it loss leader, let them use it. It's unconstitutional to say what they can sell it for.
You also do some lecturing at the colleges, is that right?
Well, I've spoken several times, not necessarily at the college, but I've spoke twice at the Kentucky Dairy Conference, which is put on by the university in terms of management things that I've done, and I've spoken at as a president of the Kentucky Dairy Record several times to various groups. I've talked to sanitarians several times just from my standpoint as a farmer, dairy farmer, what should be done and shouldn't be done and what have you.
Katie, you also work some with the county extension, the Dairymen's Wives. Can you tell what your organization does a little bit?
Well, our Dairy Wives group is just a group of women who are related, connected with the dairy. We try to promote milk and our dairy products and have a good relationship with the consumer and the general public. Just this past year I was asked to serve on the Extension Council, so I haven't been in that long enough to tell you exactly what that's going to involve, but I hope that I can have some input and, you know, serve as well as can be expected.
Les, do you feel it's possible for the small farmer to compete successfully against the large farmers in the dairy industry today?
Well, that's you see almost a trend anymore of the farms going to larger sizes. We're kind of headed that direction in a way ourselves, and yet we don't want to. We'd rather milk half the number of cows, and yet if we milked half the number of cows, we couldn't pay our bills and we'd be out of business. So a lot of them are being forced in that direction, at least I'm speaking of primarily dairy farmers, but they're heading in that direction, and yet you can see some small farms, family farms are being run by the family, and keeping labor costs down, keeping capital costs down, that are doing very well. If you look on a national basis, probably some of the, especially in the grain side of it, the grain farmers who have opted over the last 10 years, they've bought more land, they've rented more land, bigger equipment, hired more people and gotten away from the family farm, have been the ones that have been filing for bankruptcy. So, you know, it's kind of, you don't know which way the thing is going. You see, I think you have to build in efficiency. And I think a small farmer or a large farmer, either way, has to be efficient. This is why I preach so much that in Kentucky, our average production per cow is less than 9,000 pounds. In the county, it's about 8,800 and something. And when you look at, it's hard for me to imagine somebody being able to make money milking cows at that level of production. You look at the state of Oregon, they just went over 16,000. So they're, from a standpoint of competitiveness, they're milking the same cow, the same number of cows, and getting twice the production. And so you can't say that you don't think their inputs or that, you know, their expenses would be that high. So they've got to be making more money. It doesn't cost that much more to feed the cow. Labor-wise, you're going to still have to milk the cow. You have to still have the same type of equipment. So I think we have to be more competitive, regardless whether they're going to be big or small. A small farmer that's not going to stay up to date on the latest management techniques and try to increase and improve production and at the same time hold down capital outlays will always make it, I think.
If you could go back and start over again, what would you do differently in your operation?
Oh, that's hard to say. I guess sometimes you look back and say, gosh, I wish I'd never started to begin with. I should have just stayed at home. Because from a standpoint of pressure, there's probably a lot less pressure because we weren't financially as deep in debt, and probably the work didn't change that much. But she says not. I don't think our work, we worked hard there too. But we did have some relief. My brother was always there to help relieve if needed. He's taken a lot of pressure off of me because he did the farming side of it. And I guess if we'd look back on it, I think probably I would have looked for a smaller farm, something that, say, we've often thought, could you make it if you went back and had fewer acres and bought more of your grains and rather than buy all the production equipment and all the farm that you need. This is kind of what they do in the West. They don't buy a lot of land. They may milk 1,000 cows on 10 acres of land, and they buy all the everything brought in. But you take a look at the size of this farm, and you're paying taxes, you're paying interest, you're making your payments on the entire 274 acres, and yet I've got maybe 125, 130 acres that are tillable. The rest is either woodlands or it's pasture, and it's kind of non-productive, especially your woodlands, your gullies and things are all non-productive. And could you say instead of making a $200,000 or $300,000 investment in a large farm, could you buy 10 acres of a farm, a lot less investment? You wouldn't need near the equipment, and still put 70 or 80 cows in there and buy all your feed. Be in the business of buying feed so you can buy it at the right time and set up a supply chain and buy it at the least price. We've thought about that. We don't know whether that would work or not, but we've thought about it. None of us really likes to farm. we don't mind milking, but we don't like to take away from and go to the farm.
What do you see in the future for your farm?
Well, if we survive. I always say that's somebody says, well, how are you doing? I say, well, we're surviving. And that's almost a month-to-month, year-to-year type of thing. But I see us probably staying in terms of herd size about where we're at now. And we're tremendously pleased by the number of young cattle we've got now, and we feel like the genetics are probably about as good as they've been in the times we've been in the dairy business. We've got some real good genetics in our heifers coming along. We've had a good heifer production this year, so that's 2-3 years down the road to have those in the milk line. But we think every time you put one of those good ones in, that you can take one that hasn't been as good a producer out and increase your production. We probably have reached our, I won't say we've reached our limit, but we've probably done a lot of the things on the farm over the years, such as improve our water supply and conservation work and this type of thing, that we won't have to do a lot of that in the future. Equipment's in pretty good shape. We don't see any major purchases there. There's 3 or 4 things that we'll have paid for in the next 3 or 4 years that will help us on a cash flow standpoint. So I think if we could survive 3 or 4 years, it'll get better. And that's basically what a lot of farmers feel. If they can just survive, they know it's going to get better.
Katie, is there anything you would like to add to what has been said in the interview today? Okay. Les, in conclusion, would you speculate on what you see as the future for farmers in general?
Well, of course, there's always going to be a need for farmers. Their role may change. I've never considered a farmer any less than a good businessman. He has to be. I think it's just a business. It's a tradition, maybe. But I think the farmers of the future are going to be better educated. They're going to be using computers to do their job better. They're going to use mechanization wherever it can be used to increase production. I think they're keeping better financial records to understand their budgets, their cash flow, this type of thing, strictly putting it on a business basis. The farmers in the future will always get better. We haven't even seen that. We think we're good producers now, but I think there's room for a lot more growth in feed grains, beef cattle production, or whatever it might be. As I said before, the production in Kentucky is per cow is something like 8,800. And yet we have herds that are above 25,000. So we could increase threefold. There's always new products coming on the horizon. They've got a new product now that's they're testing that they can give a cow a shot, a hormone shot per day, and raise your her milk production by 30% to 40%. And they're predicting that the people that are working on this, the extension people, are now predicting that you'll see a national herd average of 20,000 pounds by the year 2000. And this will decrease the number or the need for the number of cows. It will cause a lot of farmers to go out of business because you don't need the number of cows. So, again, you get back to efficiency and keeping up with changing times. And the farmer that can do that will probably survive.
Thank you.